When I was growing up, I had one primary association with the word fellowship, and that was coffee. Every Sunday after worship, we had our fellowship hour. And what that meant is that the adults of the congregation would stand around in circles drinking coffee and having polite conversation while children pleaded desperately with their parents to leave as soon as possible. The writer Frederick Buechner has said that the word fellowship, because the word fellowship has become reduced to its associations with things such as coffee, it has lost its meaning and power. It no longer has that get up and go that it once had, that driving, rousing call to it that it once had. And I know that might offend some of you because in this church, some of us like to think of coffee as the third sacrament after baptism and communion, right? We can't have church without it. And just down the road from us, there's actually a church called the Coffee Church. Now, not wanting to be outdone, I want to suggest to you that we rechristen ourselves the Grande Mocha Church. I think Buechner's right. The word fellowship has lost some of its power, and this has becomes a particular problem with our scripture for today because John is giving a rousing call to Christians, and that is it's a rousing call to fellowship. And I think John had more in mind than coffee. Fellowship was what was supposed to define the Christian community. It's what's supposed to get people excited and draw people into the Christian community. And so I think the challenge for us is to think about how we can retranslate that word for today to bring back some of that meaning and power that it once had. And scholars come up with all sorts of theoretical ideas about how to translate that, but I think what we need are some stories that can help bring that word back to life. So this morning I want to share with you a couple of stories. The first story comes from a hospital chaplain. And this chaplain had a spiritual practice I had never heard of before. I'm not sure if it's associated with a particular faith tradition or denomination. But what she would do is she would go throughout the hospital looking to bless the hands of everyone who worked there. And needless to say, some people were a little bit startled by her offer. And she didn't just bless the hands of surgeons before a particularly delicate surgery. She blessed everyone's hands. And what she found was that people were quite touched by the gesture. I think people who might have even been skeptical about the idea of their hands being blessed, they found themselves moved by the thoughtfulness and the caring and the recognition of their work that the gesture represented. Now, she took her mission seriously, and so she went into all the corners of the hospital and all the nooks and crannies of the basement. And in one windowless room of the basement, she found a person whose job was to prepare and pack all of the surgical instruments for each operation. And the way it worked was that there would be a name at the top of a piece of paper, and underneath that name would be all of the instruments that were needed for that person's operation. And what she would do is she would read the name, and she would pray for that patient. And she had been doing that for 40 years. And what the chaplain found out is that just about everyone who worked in that windowless room of the basement did just that. Now, these people never saw the people who were having the operations. They never met them. They never even knew the results of the operation. And yet, they cared deeply about the effect of their work. It's important to recognize that work. And I dare say that it's because of what they did in that room that kept them motivated and making their life and their work meaningful day after day, 40 years on. Now, the chaplain who told this story, she told it for a couple of reasons. The first reason was that she was about to leave her job, and her colleagues wanted to know what words of wisdom she wanted to share before she moved on. And so her advice to them was to always tend to moments such as that, moments like that encounter with the people in that windowless room of the basement. Not to brush by those moments, not to be too busy to experience them, but to stop, to be present, and to listen. The second significant thing about her story is that often in a large institution like a hospital, it can be easy to overlook all of the work, the necessary and vital work that's done, and to hear the stories of those people who are present. And I don't know about you, when the last time you went to the hospital, did you think about the person who prepared and packed the surgical instruments? I never even know that job existed. And yet, how many of us want that person to do a really good job, right? Especially if you're the one being operated on. Kind of imagine, right? Time to close up. Sutures. Okay. It's important and vital work that's done. Now, last weekend we had the social justice revival at our church. And there was a lot of powerful moments here. The music from the choirs was powerful. The speakers and the preacher were powerful. But there's one moment in particular for me that was especially powerful. And it came in a windowless room of our basement. All of our guests were downstairs in Bradford eating lunch. And all of a sudden, one of them called out, "Let's give a round of applause for our cooks." And people spontaneously broke into applause. And the divider was down over the kitchen. And so the people in the kitchen couldn't hear that they were being applauded for. And so I went back there, and there were about six cooks back there working their culinary magic. And I brought them out, and they received the applause. And I almost got teary-eyed. It's not because I love food so much. I got teary-eyed because I knew as those volunteers and other volunteers who were here that day that made that event happen and that made it a success and that they were being recognized and appreciated for what they did. I think it's important that we recognize that work and those moments in those windowless rooms of the basement. Because I think ultimately that's what makes us a grande mocha church. That's what makes this place run and operate. I think it's important that we reflect on why it is that we do some of that work that's behind the scenes. I think part of it's because we care. We care about this church. We care about being of service to others. We care enough to pitch in and help out in whatever way we can. And I think, in a way, that work that's in those windowless rooms is a metaphor for what we do today with our stewardship pledges. That work that's done in those rooms isn't done for applause or the limelight. And when we do our pledges, nobody's going to announce publicly who gives what or how much. There's not going to be any applause. Nobody's name's going to be on the marquee. None of that happens. We all do it in part because we care and because there's a loving spirit that runs through each one of us in this place. I think this is part of what got John fired up about his church and fellowship and what they called koinonia back then. Now, there's another aspect, I think, to fellowship and koinonia that I think yet another story brings out for us. It's the story of Paul Crawley and Anthony Esparza. And the story begins in the parking lot of a VA hospital in West Los Angeles. It's in this parking lot that Esparza has his trailer. It's his place of business. I would call it his place of ministry. And every month, he gives about 200 haircuts in that trailer for veterans who often can't afford a haircut. And he's never turned anyone down. He's been known to give haircuts for an orange, for a ball of rubber bands, for pebbles, rocks, washers. He gives a haircut to whoever walks in through his doors. And he's been doing this since the 1970s. Paul Crawley is now his assistant. But the first time Crawley came to him, it was for a haircut, and Crawley, as he remembers it, he came drunk. As he recalls it, he was filthy and scraggly. He hadn't shaved in weeks. He stunk to high heaven. And spiritually, he had lost all hope. And he came in there, and through the simple act of a haircut, Esparza was able to give him, enabled him to feel something that he hadn't felt in a long time. And that was to feel normal. Esparza likes to say that Abe Lincoln once declared, "Never underestimate the power of a good haircut." Lincoln actually never said that, but he should have said it, right? And what Crawley has noticed in being his assistant to Esparza is that he's seen veterans come in, and often that haircut is their first step on the path of recovery. They get a haircut, they get treated with respect, and soon they're coming back around. And they start to turn their lives around. And soon they're going back out into the world, and they're looking for work or doing whatever they need to do. Esparza likes to say that we comb our hair backwards because we're going to move forward. And it's through the simple gift of a haircut that enables people to get on that path moving forward by giving the gift of dignity and a sense of possibility. And Crawley lifts up one word in particular to capture what it is that Esparza offers and what he does. And it's the word interaction. Transformation doesn't occur in a vacuum, and it occurs through our interactions with other people. And I think that's part of what got John fired up about his Grande Mocha church. What gets me fired up about our church is that we're a place of interaction, and it's through our interactions with each other and with the broader world that we become a caring community, a community in which we can see and feel the love of God. Now, John was writing some 70 years after the death of Jesus. And what was going on at that time was that people were distorting the memory of Jesus. People were saying that Jesus was not actually a human. He was a spiritual being of a different realm. And so John set them straight. Jesus was someone that they could hear, see, and touch as a human among them. And I believe that today we can see, hear, and touch the living presence of Christ in this community. It's through those interactions that we're able to do that. It's through those interactions that we're able to get a glimpse of something that is truly significant, truly meaningful, truly transformative. Esparza's nickname is the Dreamer. And I like to think that they gave him that nickname because he sees a future where others don't see one. Where other people see a bum, a drunk, a wasted life, he sees promise, potential, possibility. He sees a person in their full humanity. And at our best, I think we are a community of dreamers. We get a glimpse of the kingdom. And it's that glimpse that allows us to live on the promise of what we see, that allows us to live as a community on faith. And this is what makes us more than a Grande Mocha church. This is what makes us a place of fellowship, a place of koinonia, and a place that gets me fired up about this church, our family. Amen.